On this week's 51%, a Massachusetts artist returns to Armenia to empower women in an ancient art.
I heard amazing stories about these manuscripts, but women have never been part of that tradition in terms of making them.
And we tune into an essay about a lockdown drill. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Massachusetts artist Susie Banks Baum returned to Armenia in November to continue leading her New Illuminations, a workshop that introduces Armenian women to the art of bookmaking, an integral part of their culture, but where they have been absent from the tradition. Baum's workshop empowers women to learn the skill of this ancient art, to tell stories of their lives through the books they make, illuminating women's experiences through contemporary manuscripts. I caught up with Baum before she departed for her third trip to Armenia, second for the workshop, and she starts by talking about what happened last time around.
When I traveled in November 2016, I had planned to do one workshop with 15 women artists in the city of Gyumri. It's the second largest city in Armenia and quite far away from Yerevan, the main city, and somewhat isolated in that regard, you know, away from the sort of more contemporary pulse of Armenia in the, you know, of contemporary Armenia. So Gyumri has a feeling of being a very old city with an upsurge of young people kind of looking for Armenian identity, you know, trying to match the modern world and this really old culture that they live in. So I went there with this project to teach a group of 15 women artists bookmaking skills, which hearken to the Armenian tradition of handmade manuscripts, which is an art form that hasn't been practiced in the last 100 years since the Soviet occupation. And to my knowledge, so far, I haven't found any book artists in Armenia. So the idea was to give them back, basically, this skill that's a valued art form, but has never been practiced by a woman in Armenia. The books really rose out of the monastic tradition of illuminated manuscripts. They are treasured for their philosophy, religious writing, gospels, farm practices, village practices. I heard amazing stories about these manuscripts, but women have never been part of that tradition in terms of making them. That was sort of the technical endeavor with this workshop. But the interior, or the more sort of community level mission, was to give these women a sense of community. As I've learned more and more about communities who are traumatized, basically, through historical trauma, through the earthquake, through steady presence of poverty in their communities, there is not a sense of community among the women. So I wanted to give them experiences that they could share in common, where they could take risks artistically and personally and socially, and begin to weave a social fabric among them. And as you say, that's perhaps a goal that isn't something that can be achieved in just one four-day workshop. Through the sort of benefit of social media, I'm connected to many of the women. And as I prepare for my return there, I find that they are pulling more and more women interested in this project towards the project. So I think I accomplished my goals for November 2016. It was a giant endeavor to bring this to them. I don't speak Armenian. I work very closely with my translator and coordinator, Ani Ginyotsian. And in about 2 hours into the first eight-hour day of our workshop, the language thing wasn't an issue. We were already speaking an artistic language that language was a part of, but my lack of Armenian did not impede these women getting these skills. And they made extraordinary books. I kind of expected that they would make books that would be beautiful, but first or second books. But when someone picks up these really ancient tools, needle, thread, folded paper, painted paper, bookboard, piercing tools, and feels an ease and confidence with them. I felt like they were, that some part of them was remembering this themselves. Like there was, and I don't mean this in a magical woo-woo way. I mean that for, if you, Allison, took a look at the books, you would see things that you would say, that bears the mark of the maker. They're not just recreating something I've instructed them with. They have already imbued the first book that they put their hands into with their own artistic expression. And that was exactly what I wanted to have happen. One woman, Sylvie Knarr, who's a knitter and needleworker, brought a bunch of macrame thread, and I taught them how to cut a frame in this book board so they could embellish that frame. Most people usually put an image in the frame, so it's like a picture frame on the front of these beautiful hardbound books. But Sylvie Knarr needed my help to help her anchor 20 pieces of macrame, long pieces of red, thick macrame thread. And she started to, once they were anchored and glued and secure, she started to weave. And she said, you know, it was toward the end of the day and she had to go home and take care of her baby and sort of continue with her day. She said, I'll work on this in the night. And she came back the next morning and she had woven this small, we would say sort of a wall hanging or this decorative piece of macrame that became a flap on the front of her book that has the look of some sort of sacred textile. It's, you know, the embellishment was far more advanced than a beginner would just strike on. So I was really boosted by their, by how far they went with the books and people who witnessed the exhibit. We had an exhibit that ran for a month in Central Gyumri. And the curator who produced the exhibit, Anna Gargarian, produced events at the exhibit every weekend, dance performance, a talk about a book, all kinds of events that drew a variety of people in to see the work. And the feedback we got and the enjoyment that was evident in the people who were there just was so exciting to see. The most affirming thing that happened, though, was at the end of the exhibit, the final weekend, Anna had invited an American woman, Erin Pignon, from Southern Methodist University. She was in Armenia working at the Manuscript Museum on a Fulbright scholarship for a year. And my Anna, the curator, invited Erin to the exhibit to see it and present her research and just witness the exhibit. And Erin came away from that exhibit offering us this long, detailed affirmation of the importance of women returning to this Armenian tradition and carrying it forward in a contemporary form that, in her knowledge of the archives of Armenian illuminated manuscripts, that there are no books made by women in the thousands of books that are around the world, Jerusalem and Boston and Ireland, Italy. There are several centers of book arts where these illuminated manuscripts exist beyond Armenia. And to her knowledge, there were no books made by women. And she felt like the skill that these women, the new illuminations artists, exhibited offered great hope for the future of this form, this iconic Armenian art form, to be expressed into the future. And that was kind of a free, you know, that was something that I did not expect, much like a theater experience. You know, if you're producing a show and you get a critic who responds to the work and gives it historical context and social context and really acknowledges how it contributes to the future well-being of the people who will experience it. That was a major gift for me and for everyone involved with the project. If I needed any affirmation beyond the response that I got from the women and the people who saw the exhibit, Erin's response just really sealed my commitment to continue with this project. That's why I'm returning.
I recall that you told me one of your goals last year was building a network of women artists and growing the body of work, and that sounds like it's happening, which is wonderful. And the other thing you described as a lofty but hopefully attainable goal was to some year have an exhibit of these illuminated manuscripts by modern women at a big museum there, please forgive me, I forget the name. But someday, some way, your hope was for this kind of exhibit to become reality, different than the exhibition you described just now. But given what you just told me, do you see this goal as a bit less lofty?
Well, it's great that you bring me back to that point, because I've appealed to the Matenadaran, the manuscript museum, to allow me to bring the advanced artists to the museum for a special tour and a tour of the restoration department, which is a very respected space. It's not a public space. You can't just stop in on it. And I wrote through Erin to the woman who's the head of the international relations at the museum. And I just got permission from the acting director of the museum for us to have a special tour. So for that gentleman to acknowledge these artists as worthy of this special tour is for me a step in that direction. And I don't see it as lofty anymore. I see it as something into the future. You know, I think they do need to build skills and a little more diversity and more perhaps women from other cities or villages involved in the project. But that doesn't seem so far away to me now.
Wow, and it's been just a year. Congratulations on the access. Access is what so much of this is about. So I'm curious what your goals are this time around and whether the political landscape, and I'll just leave that in a general sense, would have any bearing.
Well, the Financial Times published a special issue about gender equality throughout the world. And there's a piece about selective abortions in Armenia and how Armenians favor the male child. And the fact that that article is now in the news, 2017, for me, there's a growing world awareness of these issues in sort of quieter countries in the Caucasus region, places that don't have, there's immense turmoil in Armenia, but I mean that they're not at the front of the news these days. But the fact that this issue is still contributing to the women's lives and the expectations they have in their culture, the feeling of opportunity or simple welcome that women feel as participating members of Armenian society. I think it's really hard for us in the States to understand what it is to be a person of such low value. The current political state of the United States puts me very much more in mind of that. I don't take my freedom lightly. Nor do I take my freedom of movement or speech or employment lightly today. When I was in Armenia last year, it was during the election, and I had voted with my absentee ballot before I got there. And when our current president was elected, and I was quite surprised by that, the women said, oh, you know, we're used to that kind of talk. We know all about that. And so I entered this period of time with them, this next month that I'll be spending with several different groups of women and interviewing more women and working with a group of teenagers, ever more dedicated to their stories having a home, that their stories of their daily lives being valued and important and contributing to the potential for change for women's lives to be valued in their country. And for them to just experience that sort of solidity of presence. I am here. I have made this work. It is imbued with my life experience, however contorted it may be by contemporary standards. And it's important enough to be seen by the public.
So you'll be teaching one four-day workshop for your advanced students, and then what?
And then I'll have another set of 4 days with a group of beginning book artists. And these are women of all ages who, like the women who came to me last year, have never engaged in making hand-bound books. And my goal is to have two or three of my advanced artists with me to help teach that workshop. Because one of the main components of this project is for these women to gain confidence as teachers, gain confidence and skill so that they can carry this work forward without my presence. And then I will work the following week, the third week I'm there, I will work with a group of teen photographers at an organization called the CASA Foundation, which provides family support in Gyumri and many sort of after-school classes. And last year, they invited me to teach a visual storytelling workshop. And I worked with this great group of kids from 12 to 16. And they want to learn to make books, too. So we're going to use their photographs and create a story in books that they will also build. And I'm really excited about that. I feel like those young people are really paying attention to what's going on in their country and what's going on in the world. They have more access to information, to a variety of information, and they also see what is an Armenian identity. They're passionate about their city. They wanted to take me on photo walks last year, and one little guy, oh my gosh, this kid was just, he was so quiet, but he did the writing exercises I taught, and on the day that I said, okay, we're going to go on a photo walk tomorrow, and he said, I know where we're going. And the next day he shows up, he got permission for us to visit this old, really broken house, broken by the earthquake. But he felt like the building itself had this Armenian identity, this Gyumri identity that he wanted me to see and that we all photographed. And it was one of those moments in time where I felt like this kid, I could never have met him. And yet I've come to his city and asked him what really lights you up about where you live. And he wanted us all to witness this place, and he made sure we could do it safely. I just felt like, I don't know, it was really exciting. So I'll teach that workshop, and then I'll return to Yerevan and weave my way back to the States.
That was Susie Banks Baum, artist, writer, and community organizer, who returned to Armenia in November to lead her new eliminations workshop. She resides in the Berkshires region of Massachusetts. I spoke with her around this time in 2016 as she was about to embark on leading her first workshop there. That interview is in 51% show number 1425, online at WAMC.org. A 23-year-old veteran of the U.S. military, now serving as the top enlisted leader of the New York Army and Air National Guard, is the first woman to hold the position. State officials say Air National Command Chief Master Sergeant Amy Giaquinto became the first Air Guard non-commissioned officer to hold the job of senior enlisted advisor to the top-ranked general in the New York National Guard. The position has been held by male New York Army National Guard Command Sergeant Majors since it was created in the 1970s. Giaquinto's military career began in 1984 with three stints in the U.S. Army. After a 10-year break in service, the Ballston Spa resident joined the Air Guard's 109th Airlift Wing in Schenectady County. We close the show with an essay from writer Dr. Jerry Burns.
I am continually amazed at the power of words. I am also amazed at how impotent they can be if I close my ears to their true meaning. Recently, my husband and I were telling stories in an elementary classroom when there was an announcement. We couldn't hear it. The intercom in the room wasn't working properly, so we continued telling our tale. The teacher walked to the other side of the room. She quickly closed the blinds, locked the classroom door, and shut off the lights. Then she came over to us and gently said, "We are in lockdown." It was a drill, but it was my first. Everyone else, including Barry, knew the drill. We herded children to another part of the classroom and huddled together in a dark corner. Children squirmed. A few started talking, but the teacher raised her fingers to her lips. "Shh, we must be silent in a lockdown." I felt my insides coil into a ball. I mean, this was a lockdown. My intellect understood that it was a drill, but my emotions were locked on lockdown. I didn't want the children to notice that I was imploding into a puddle, so I smiled at them and then looked at Barry. His ability to read my nonverbal cues, honed after many years of performing and living together, told him my emotional state. To others, I looked like my normal self. To him, a skittish cat on caffeine. The kids did their best to remain quiet. Despite age-appropriate wiggling and squirming, they seemed rather calm. Like a clueless tourist, I gazed around the room, imagining what it would be like if this was not a drill. The images were far from pleasing, and this imaginative excursion wasn't loosening the tight knot of my insides. Like everyone else, I've read about school lockdowns. I knew how and why they happened. Like everyone else, I have been appalled that school children are at risk of this unspeakable societal blight. But before that day, I never truly understood what lockdown means. Time passed slowly. It was eerily quiet. Then, we heard the click of heels in the hallway. It was the principal making the rounds to check every room in the building. Her echoing steps in the empty hallway made it impossible not to imagine a lone shooter coming for us carrying rat-a-tat potential in hand. Just as this awful image entered my head, the principal rattled the door to the classroom. And that rattled me. The ball of nerves inside me bounced into my throat and down to my toes, and I gave Barry another terrified kitty look and turned and smiled at the kids. Oh, this was going just great. The principal unlocked the door and told us to stay put and silent until we heard an announcement. Now, expecting young children to do this is a minor miracle, but the teacher's gentle command of the space and her patient reminders grounded them and me. Her work was medal-worthy. Seeing children huddle together against the possibility of mad violence curdles my maternal soul. What must it do to the teacher's soul? But I also noticed something else. A newbie to lockdowns, I was filled with terror because this drill had real-life potential. The real thing really happens. I visualized all the possible ways that trouble could come and how I might deal with it. Barry, on the other hand, was chill. The teacher seemed calm and easy, and other than having a good case of the wiggles, the kids were just hanging out. Lockdown drills didn't seem to inspire terror in any of them. Much like fire drills don't seem to do. They are procedures, almost bureaucratic. Maybe that's by design. What we put children through with lockdowns is huge, and what we put the teachers through is also huge. They shepherd children through very difficult drills, maintain calm, and imagine what they would do if the awful phrase, "This is not a drill," accompanied the announcement. It's all up to them. The word lockdown is potent for me now. But for how long? Barry tells me, I felt like you did the first time I had a drill, but you get used to it. Do I want to get used to it? Do I want the word lockdown to lose the power I experienced? Is that denial healthy for me? For society? And here's another question. Does a matter-of-fact automatic walkthrough of a drill protect children from trauma? I don't know the answer to any of these questions, but I believe that it's important for adults to understand the gravity of the phrase school lockdown. I also want to send a starburst of thanks to every teacher who sits in quiet, dark corners, vigilantly protecting children from the potency of the word lockdown and the potentiality of a real one, which I fervently hope and pray never, ever, ever happens again.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com. She also is an adjunct professor in the Department of Communication at the State University of New York at New Paltz. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org and follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1480.